for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton urged Asian leaders meeting in Hanoi today to up the pressure on North Korea to curb its nuclear ambitions. She said they pose a security threat to the entire region. The British government sent mixed signals this week on its time frame for withdrawing UK troops from Afghanistan and in a move to protect Syria's secular identity. The government has banned full Islamic face veils for women students and teachers at universities. Joining me in the studio for the week's top international stories on the Friday News Roundup, Moises Naim of El País, Courtney Cuby of NBC, and Tom Jelton of NPR. Throughout the hour, I'll look forward to hearing from you. Your comments, your questions are always an important part of the program. I look forward to your calls on 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you and welcome. Courtney, it's good to have you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Hi, Diane.
Tom Jelton, North Korea is now threatening a physical response to planned war games in the Sea of Japan this weekend. Tell us what the story is.
The United States and South Korea next week will be holding these joint military exercises off the Yellow Sea, off the coast of the Korean Peninsula. And obviously, the North Koreans see this as something directed against them. In fact, statements from the Pentagon would certainly suggest that this was meant to send a message to North Korea about reflecting the anger of the South Korean side over the sinking of the Cheonan and the support of the United States for South Korea's position. The problem with this, however, Diane, is that 4 months have passed since that ship was sunk. And how can you possibly make an argument that this is meant as a response to North Korea when all this time has passed? In addition to that, the White House seems to be bending over backward to say reassuring words that this is just the kind of exercise that allies normally undertake. So a mixed message between the Pentagon and the White House. I think too much time has passed for this really to be taken all that seriously by the North Koreans.
Moises.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the larger context to this is that North Korea, as we know, is a totalitarian police state that depends heavily on personality cults. And there is a succession going on. And there's a young son of the current dictator that is taking over, and he needs a narrative. They need to build a heroic narrative for him that includes the fact that he was the leader that has taken on the South Korean Navy and everything associated with these exercises. So that's one issue to keep in mind. The other is that the Chinese government is not happy about these exercises. As you know, the China claims the Yellow Sea and doesn't like the notion that these foreign powers are conducting military naval operations in the Yellow Sea.
It's interesting that the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, has expressed deep concerns about the sinking of the South Korean ship. Has anyone gotten absolute proof that it was North Korea that sank this ship, Courtney?
Well, the United States believes without a doubt that North Korea was the one who sunk the Cheonan back in March, killing 46 sailors. Secretary of State Clinton, Secretary of Defense Gates have both said, without a doubt, that North Korea was responsible for the torpedo attack that sunk the ship. That being said, the UN Security Council issued a statement several weeks ago that while it condemned the action, it didn't actually blame North Korea for the attack.
Because
of China's participation at the UN. And China refuses to acknowledge that North Korea was involved. And Secretary of State Clinton visited China back in May, the end of May, and you know, I was on the trip with her. On the way back, we got assurances that China was going to be on board with the UN Security Council, that they would be that they would condemn North Korea for this, but that in fact had never happened.
So, Tom, what kind of physical response is North Korea implying?
I doubt very much that this is a moment when the particularly with a U.S. aircraft carrier battle group approaching Korean waters, and that includes the Michigan, the USS Michigan, which is a nuclear-powered submarine that carries cruise missiles. And if there's one thing that really frightens the North Koreans, it's cruise missiles, because they have no defense against cruise missiles. This would not be a real smart moment to sink another ship, let's put it that way. So I think that this is one more example of bellicose, you know, blustery rhetoric from the North Korean side. I doubt we're going to see a whole lot more than that.
Do you agree?
I absolutely agree. I don't think that's in the cards. And what is in the cards is that North Korea is also suffering from the global economic crisis. They're hurting very badly in a variety of ways. So this is a country where shortages and scarcity is always there, but this has tightened even more. And there's an embargo coming their way that has to do with pressuring them to stop their nuclear program.
Interesting little tidbit, Diane, to underscore what Moises just said. North Korea is so dependent on China that they are basically just giving away resources to China. The last example, an interesting one, they have given China the right to harvest octopus in their own waters. I mean, they don't have the wherewithal to exploit
that.
Their own resources.
Wow.
They really are so dependent on China.
All right, let's turn to another place where Secretary of State Clinton was visiting this week. She was first in Pakistan, then in Afghanistan. She announced a significant aid package to Pakistan. Courtney, how important to Pakistan is that package?
Well, Secretary Clinton, she wanted to introduce this money in these aid projects as a way to move beyond Pakistan as just a security dialogue and to bolster the infrastructure there to combat the anti-Americanism that really is throughout the country growing to a certain extent.
Because they believe...
The number one cause of anti-Americanism there is the drone attacks in the federally administrated tribal areas. But the projects themselves, I think even more so than the $500 million that are involved, is the fact that the cities that they've chosen. There's Lahore, which has recently seen, you know, a Sufi shrine blown up, several suicide attacks, believed to be sectarian in nature. Peshawar, also suicide attacks, including one against the U.S. consulate earlier this spring. Karachi, again, more sectarian attacks. So they've chosen these very strategic locations to funnel this aid into, to try and build up a sense of trust for the Americans.
Does Pakistan have good reason to feel so mistrustful of the U.S., Tom?
It's hard for us Americans to see a good reason when considering how much money we have poured into Pakistan. You know, this latest package is part of a larger $7 billion package in non-military aid on top of about $11 billion since 9/11, since 2001. We're approaching now $20 billion in aid to Pakistan. You know, I read one comment the other day that Pakistan may be receiving as much aid from the United States as it collects in tax revenue in its own country. I mean, this if you could buy loyalty, that would, you know, we would think that Pakistan would love us, but clearly money does not buy friendship.
But this goes way back, doesn't it, to the fact that the U.S. sort of deserted Pakistan after it asked for Pakistan's aid. to help defeat the Soviets?
No, and there is a right intuition behind your very good question. Let's remember that when 9/11 took place, Pakistan was under an embargo. Pakistan had bought U.S. fighter planes and paid for them, but the United States decided not to deliver them. The Pakistan and President Musharraf were not allies of the United States. And then in 24 hours after 9/11, the United States decided that Pakistan was its best friend in the region. It lifted the embargo. It started this massive aid program that Tom mentioned, $7.5 billion. Most of it, however, is in military aid. And so Secretary Clinton in this trip insisted that the United States is not just about security and war. And that's why the package that Courtney mentioned, the $500 million package, includes two hydroelectric dams, funding for drinking waters, health center, irrigation plants, all sorts of civilians initiatives that have to do with development and infrastructure more than war.
Is that going to make a difference, Tom?
Those are projects that are very important in Pakistan. And, you know, the government there has really improved its capability. And, you know, I think that, we certainly don't see as much corruption in Pakistan, for example, as we do in Afghanistan. So I think it's realistic to think that those projects will actually bear some fruit in Pakistan. Whether that'll make a the difference in the attitude toward the United States is another question.
Tom Chilton, he's correspondent for NPR, author of Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba. Courtney Kuby is national security producer for NBC News. Courtney just returned from a reporting trip to Afghanistan 2 days ago. Moises Naim is with El País. Short break, right back. And welcome back to the International Hour of our Friday News Roundup this week with Courtney Kuby. She's national security producer for NBC News. Moises Naim, he's chief international columnist for El País. And Tom Gelton, correspondent for NPR. Let's talk about Secretary Clinton's stop in Afghanistan, Courtney, at a time when a lot of Americans are certainly raising questions about how long we're going to be there, whether we are going to change strategy, what happened.
Well, Secretary Clinton, she went to Kabul for the Kabul conference, which was a gathering of more than 70 foreign ministers from around the world, including India, Iran, you know, Great Britain. And the State Department would argue that she had a successful trip, that the ministers were able to agree on the final joint communique that came out of the conference. I think that the most important element of that was President Karzai's comments that he wants the Afghan National Security Forces to take over all security and military operations by 2014. And more than that, because he said that during his inauguration several months ago, is the fact that all of the foreign ministers signed off and agreed to that date. So that was a significant finding that came out of the conference itself. Secretary Clinton herself, you know, met with General Petraeus, with Ambassador Eikenberry, with all of the big players. And reconciliation didn't come up quite as much as everyone had anticipated.
I thought it was interesting that the front page story in the Washington Post this morning was about questions regarding how much support President Karzai has with his push to negotiate with the Taliban, Moises.
And that's a good question for which we don't have an answer. I don't think Karzai has an answer, in fact. Afghanistan is such a fragmented country with loyalties shifting and moving by the day that it's unclear. Behind all this is the debate between calendars and conditions, between deadlines and realities. Everyone wants the foreign troops to leave. Publics in the United States and in England and in the NATO country want out. Many Afghans want them out. And so the debate, as I said, is do they leave at a set date or do they leave when conditions on the ground change? And that is the underlying debate that is taking place, and we saw manifestations of this week when Prime Minister Cameron from the United Kingdom was here, and he said one thing in Washington, was his deputy prime minister back in the House of Commons was saying something else. Again, calendars versus conditions. Cameron was stressing conditions, and Deputy Prime Minister Clegg was stressing we are leaving.
So, have we got some sense of any differences, any developments, any changes in General McChrystal's policy toward Afghanistan and now General Petraeus's approach?
It seemed to me, Diane, to be really small differences. There was a story this week that General Petraeus felt that General McChrystal, who came from a special operations background, was focusing too much on hunting down bad guys and not enough on building up support for the government within the Afghan population, and that he wants to shift to a little bit more of a traditional counterinsurgency strategy, which is really meant to build support for the government. But, McChrystal supporters say that, in fact, he was doing that as well. I mean, at most, this is a slight change in emphasis. I think that General Petraeus has a more political clout here in Washington. He's made it known that while he will support President Obama's idea of beginning a withdrawal in the summer of next year, he's probably going to want to slow the clock down a little bit and probably is going to be in a better position to kind of put the brakes on that withdrawal than General McChrystal would have been in.
Courtney?
Yeah, I agree completely. General Petraeus will continue the counterinsurgency strategy that General McChrystal began. I mean, we remember Petraeus literally wrote the manual on counterinsurgency for the U.S. military. But I think we'll see a slightly different implementation than General McChrystal had, and even more focus on the Afghan National Security Forces, which need tremendous work before they're able to take any real lead in operations. We'll see continued support for the Karzai government and ability and attempt to build them up, to shore up the government around the country, outside of Kabul. And then, less hunting down of individual Taliban leaders than maybe we had seen, as Tom was saying, with General McChrystal. And I think we're already seeing small instances of Petraeus's strategy today. The first is this local community police force that he's recently gotten Karzai to agree with. And this sort of has elements of the Sons of Iraq and Iraq that we saw several years ago. It's a local policing force that can give tips to the Americans, but won't actually conduct any offensive operations.
Well, I want to get to Iraq, so you've gotten us right there. Number one, are we seeing an upswing in violence, and will we see the U.S. reduce its presence by 50,000 troops next month, Moises?
There is undoubtedly an increase in violence. There has been very, very heavy violence. 48 people were killed over the last weekend, 15 killed later in the week. This has been the deadliest in Iraq since last spring. So we are seeing a surge of killings. The most recent ones were targeted at the Awakening Councils. As you may recall, these are the groups that helped the surge be successful. These were the sons, they started as the Sons of Iraq. These were Sunni groups that got together and initially were recruited and paid by
and
the
paid,
U.S. government.
Right.
And they were the ones that allowed the search to be successful in many, many ways. And now they're being targeted. The government have promised them that they would be included and brought into the civilian ministries. They were 20. The promise was that 20% of the people of the fighters in the Awakening Councils in the Sons of Iraq will be employed by the civilian ministers. That target is very far from being achieved. And even those that have been hired have not been paid. And so what we are seeing is more of that rift for power, between different factions, between Sunnis and Shiites, between different groups within each of these large groups. And as you said, there is no government. Let's remember that they had an election 4 months ago, and that election should have created conditions for a government, and they're still fighting it over because the power sharing is not clear.
And in the meantime, you had al-Qaeda escaping from prison, so you wonder how that happens and whether that's a deliberate move to reinvigorate that
element. That what everyone worries about is a return to the sectarian violence, Sunni on Shia violence in Iraq that was so deadly in the past. And the political stalemate that Marseilles is referring to is really aggravates that fear, because the elections were so close. There are only two parliamentary seats between the group that Ayad al-Alawi leads and the current prime minister, Nouri al-Maliki, two seats behind him. Now, Maliki is much more the Shiite leader, and if he's able to put together a Shiite coalition, and he's on the verge of doing that, this would really bode poorly for the Sunni population, and it might cause many Sunnis to sort of go back to violence. Now, Alawi is trying to put together a more secular coalition, but he doesn't have the votes to do it, and he is now forced to reach out to Muqtada al-Sadr, who is a very divisive figure in Iraqi politics. Basically, his last hope for getting a coalition together is to get Muqtada al-Sadr to support him. But Muqtada al-Sadr has been in exile in Iran for the last couple of years, and he has militia groups in Iraq who have engaged in deadly violence. So, you know, it's just really hard to see how this is going to work out in a way where these sectarian tensions are going to be resolved.
And meanwhile, you have Vice President Biden calling both the leaders of Iraq and talking to them about recent developments. What else might he have said?
Well, I mean, the U.S. is in a very difficult position right now because General Odierno was in town this week, you know, for a State Department conference on the handover to more of a civilian presence in Iraq. But at the same time, there is really a resurgent reconstituting al-Qaeda that they're facing. The U.S. is going to draw down their troops by the end of August. August 31st, Operation New Dawn begins. They'll be down at 50,000. But that being said, there'll be 50,000 troops on the ground there for another year still, U.S. troops. They're going to focus on the north. They're going to continue their focus on Baghdad in what General Odierno was calling a conflict prevention versus a combat position. So it's not the U.S. is not by any means on August 31st going to be pulling out. They'll continue to conduct counterterror operations with the Iraqis that are there.
All right, let's talk about, you mentioned that Prime Minister David Cameron was here in Washington this week, and the conversation seemed to be dominated by BP's role in the disaster in the Gulf and Lockerbie. What happened there, Moises?
Well, the first point about BP is that Prime Minister Cameron has stated that BP was being harassed beyond what was justified by their mishandling of the situation with the oil spill.
Does he have a point?
It's unclear. There is no doubt that BP has a long story of mistakes, of recklessness and mismanagement in that affair. And there is no doubt that it also exposed how, in general, the whole industry is not quite ready to be undergoing these deep sea operations and drilling operations. But let's remember that BP is a very important element of the business sector and the economy in England.
And pensions.
And there is a, it plays a very important role. So in many ways, Prime Minister Cameron was in Washington defending the national interests of Britain that are, in this case, associated with the interest of BP.
And then BP comes up again as far as Lockerbie is concerned, Tom.
Right, Diane. Well, the background to this was the decision to release the mastermind of the Lockerbie bombing. And he's, of course, a Libyan and was sent back to Libya allegedly because he was in his dying days. Well, it turns out he wasn't in his dying days.
He is not in his dying days.
Could very well live for a number of years. And one of the allegations that was made, the reason there's a BP connection here is because at the time, BP was very interested in developing oil fields in Libya. And there was some thought that this was a deal behind the scenes where if this man were released and allowed to go back to Libya, that BP would get a head start on the right to develop oil. Now, Prime Minister Cameron, whether he said this to defend BP or not, he went out of his way in interviews this week to say it was not BP that called the shots on the release of the Lockerbie bomber. It was the Scottish government, and that he was reinforced by he was in the opposition at that time, but he was very critical of that decision. So he has a little bit of credibility here. He wants all the responsibility put on the Scottish government, not on BP, for that decision.
Tom Jelton of NPR, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We should say Scotland itself is totally denying any involvement with BP. The Scottish government was, quote, never at any point, unquote, lobbied by oil giant BP. And top Scottish officials have declined an invitation to appear before a Senate panel looking at allegations of fraud and corporate pressure in this case. I found myself really baffled by the suggestion that Scottish officials should be called by a Senate committee to testify on their business actions and the release of that fellow, Moises?
Yeah, absolutely. That's called extraterritoriality. You cannot apply that. They should not come. The senators can call them and can try, but there is no point of asking a foreign government to come and testify in front of the U.S. Senate.
All right. And in Syria, Courtney, were you surprised to hear that Syria is banning face veils at public and private universities?
Well, I think we've seen more of a trend. You know, several other countries, France, you know, have recently banned face veils. With Syria, though, I think this is largely President Assad's continued attempt to maintain the secular nation. You know, he saw his father 30 years ago, face a Muslim uprising and beat it back with some harshness. And he understands the threats that his nation faces. So this is just one more attempt to rein in extremism.
Is it also an attempt to address or defeat the more conservative elements in his government don't.
Well, you know, Diane, we're so sort of ethnocentric here. We just sort of assume that, you know, to the extent that radical Islam is a force, it threatens only us. In fact, there are a lot of these Arab nationalist regimes that have their origins in Arab nationalism who are even more threatened politically by groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, you know, whether it's Egypt or Syria or in Saddam Hussein's Iraq was the same situation. These governments actually see the rise of militant Islam as threatening to their interests as well. That's a point we need to keep in mind.
And Tom, before the break, tell us quickly about Walter Myers and his wife, Gwendolyn.
Well, Walter Myers was a State Department official, a very wealthy individual from sort of the Washington, D.C. aristocracy who fell in love with Cuba and became convinced that Cuba was that the Cuban government needed support of somebody there and agreed to spy for Cuban interests and got caught.
He did not do that out of any animosity for the United States, but
solidarity for Cuba. And he's been sent to prison for life.
Tom Gelton, correspondent for NPR, Courtney Kubi of NBC, Moises Naim of El País. Short break, and we'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
If you see me get smarter.
Jimmy Webb is one of the great songwriters of the 60s and 70s. He's got a new album of duets with some of the great singers he wrote for. This is Webb with Willie Nelson, If You See Me Getting Smaller. We'll hear from Jimmy Webb and listen to more of his music on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
I'm in no hurry. I got a right to disappear.
And it's time to open the phones. Let's go first to Tom, who's in Elizabethton, Tennessee. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Thank you. I'm a graduate student at East Tennessee State University, and I know America wants good relations with the world. We want good relations with China. And we're having a dispute over Taiwan that everybody's overlooking. We have already admitted that it's a part of mainland China, yet we have in the Taiwanese Act promised to defend it. I don't know why. That's why China is not making North Korea behave. They control North Korea. And if war breaks out in the Asia Peninsula, it'll go further than just North Korea. We will be into it with China. So thank you for taking my call, and I hope everybody has a good weekend.
Thanks a lot. Any comments, Tom?
No, I think Tom is right. I think that, you know, all of these security issues in East Asia are, in fact, linked, and China is what links them all. China feels very strongly about Taiwan. It also feels very strongly that I think China's very nervous about the idea of Korea being reunified, because they're convinced that if it were reunified, it would just be South Korea. What is now South Korea would basically have the whole peninsula, and China would lose its leverage, its buffer with the West that North Korea now represents.
I want to go back for just a moment to those Cuban spies, Moises, because you knew them personally.
I knew him.
Forgive me.
You know, I attended the professional conferences and meetings with him. He was a very, very nice individual. I did not detect any ideological enthusiasm for communism or for Cuba. And what we have now learned is that he did this and he's spying. He destroyed his life and that of his family, probably, out of ideological commitment.
He took no money.
He took no money. And what we now learn is that he just did this for passion, for ideological passion, which is an old way of being spy. We no longer have spies that are driven by ideology. Today's spies are driven by money.
What kinds of secrets was he giving Cuba about the U.S.? Do we know?
I don't know, but apparently, you know, he was a senior intelligence analyst at the Bureau of the State Department, at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research. He was there for 8 years before that. In that capacity, he had access to all sorts of intelligence that he was passing. He was also talking to his colleagues and getting information from them. So there's no doubt that he was passing a lot of important information.
Tom?
Well, you ask a good question, Diane, because the United States has not long ago has given up any hope of overthrowing the Castro regime or planning any kind of, you know, covert military action there or, you know, clandestine operation. So it's not as though he was alerting the Cuban government to some kind of nefarious activities, you know, that were being planned against Cuba. I mean, Cuba just doesn't even rank that highly anymore in the U.S. security agenda. So he did have access to a lot of secret stuff, but I can't imagine that any of it was all that relevant to Cuba's defense.
Courtney?
This story just is remarkable. You know, it has all these elements of such an interesting and intriguing tale. You have a privileged Washington family, great-grandson of Alexander Graham Bell, and the way that he transmitted these facts was via shopping cart at times in a Washington, D.C. Supermarket. I mean, if that doesn't have intrigue written all over it. But in the end, the one question that no one can seem to answer is, if this man, he was doing this out of a passion for the Cuban people and for the revolution, then why was he passing information along to Fidel Castro with a history of human rights abuses? It doesn't really jive to me in the end what his real passion was.
All right, to Detroit, Michigan, and to Jean-Philippe, you're on the air.
Hello, Diana. Thanks for having my call. I have two remarks about North Korea.
All right.
You ask a very good question about what are the proofs that North Korea attacked that boat. And the question that you got was, the person said, "I believe," and that Secretary of State said something. And that immediately rang a bell, like at the UN when the past Secretary of State came and believed or maybe manufactured some proof. So it makes me a little bit nervous to see that we are maybe potentially putting the first step into a potential future conflict.
All right.
Another remark that I want to have is, is the United States doing actions like Western Germany had with Eastern Germany, with diffusing a television program to at least inform somehow the Eastern German what happens on the West and make them at least interested in joining? Is something similar happening between North and South Korea?
There is a radio, or it used to be Radio Free Asia. Does Radio Free Asia still exist? I believe it does, but you know, it doesn't reach North Korea. You know, these broadcasts are fairly easy to block, so I don't think that North Korean radios are manufactured in such a way that you can't right. tune in different stations
and television as
into,
well.
Locked
Absolutely.
Into one channel.
Yeah. Now, what he's referencing is, of course, Secretary of State Colin Powell appearing before the United Nations with charts and graphs signifying that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, which led us into war. Now, the question becomes, is someone, anyone, anywhere manufacturing the idea that North Korea hit and sank the South Korean ship Moises?
What we know is that Cheonan, that's the name of the frigate that was sunk, that 46 people died, we know it was sunk by a torpedo. We know that there was an international commission integrated by people, you know, Sweden and Norway and a variety of countries. And they, I think, reached the conclusion that there was enough evidence that this was a North Korean act. The problem there, again, is China, and the problem is the larger context that we discussed before. But, you know, that ship went down. That ship was sunk by a torpedo. So the question is, who had an interest of sinking a South Korea warship?
Why would North Korea want to do that?
As I said before, North Korea is undergoing a transition and a succession in which a young 26-year-old boy, the son of Kim Jong-il, is being anointed as the next dictator. And they need the narrative where the new dictator is a heroic military figure. And they're giving him stripes that will then justify a story where this young man is a military leader.
Ah.
There was also an incident, Diane, 4 months earlier where a North Korean ship ventured into South Korean territorial waters and there was an exchange of fire and the North Korean ship sunk. So this could be seen as retaliation for that incident as well.
All right.
Secretary Gates said just today, he's been traveling through the region this week, and he said today that it was the provocations were specifically because of the leader transition in North Korea. He's putting it directly on that reason.
All right. And to Mario, who's in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Good morning. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to make a comment pertaining to the North Korean subject is a subject that doesn't have no solution in the fact that China has the magic wand of saying yay, nay, and most likely is going to say no, as you discussed in the program earlier. My point is that the most important aspect of the future of the Middle East and the future of the financial world is Iran. If Iran attains the bomb or close to, Israel might go on their own and bombard one of their facilities or whatever aspects that they think necessary. At this point, the whole world become absolute chaos.
Tom.
You know, it's hard to disagree with that analysis. Isn't it? And it does seem in some ways that we do seem to be inching in that direction. We've seen a number of statements from U.S. officials indicating that they don't really have a lot of faith that sanctions are going to change Iran's behavior. On the other hand, there was a really interesting story in the Financial Times this morning about how Iran's nuclear program seems to be in some ways going backwards because of either incompetence on the part of Iranian scientists or, more intriguingly, sabotage by Western intelligence agencies who, because Iran has to import so much of the machinery that it needs for its nuclear industry, there is this speculation that Western intelligence agencies are sort of planting bugs in some of this equipment that cause it to malfunction. And the number of working centrifuges in Iran is now 20% below what it was just a year ago. And, you know, technical malfunctions can be explained in a variety of ways.
Now, there are those in the West who might argue that the Financial Times should not have published that piece.
I'm sure there are, but it was interesting.
Exactly. All right. Thanks for your call. Let's go to Charlotte, North Carolina. Good morning to you, Frank.
Good morning. Okay, I wanted to say two things real quick. One thing what you were talking about in Taiwan. Okay, I read in the Taiwan paper, I'm pretty sure on Monday or Tuesday, that China was manning 2,000 missiles on the Taiwan Strait. Okay, and a lot of the technology that was given to them by Israel. Okay, but the other thing that I wanted to say is that in 1999, on August the 29th, I'm pretty sure it was, Sam Donaldson was interviewing Dick Cheney. And Dick Cheney said that he asked him a question about Halliburton was doing business with. And Dick Cheney said, Libya and Iran, okay? And I wonder why Congress isn't pulling Dick Cheney in front of a committee and asking him questions about that, along with BP.
You know, Diane, there was something called the Iran-Libya Sanctions Act that imposed sanctions on Iran and Libya. And Halliburton, as a corporation, lobbied against that. And Dick Cheney, before going into government, was a critic of those sanctions.
Any comment, Moises?
The comment about Taiwan and the frictions with China, it's important. And this is an old story, an old source of frictions. But the hopeful part of the story is that now the economic ties between China and Taiwan are so deep, are so important, that at least one has the hope that will contain any attempt at escalating the frictions into an all-out conflict.
What about the idea of 2,000 missiles going to China from Israel? Do we know that to be a fact?
I did not hear that.
Okay.
All right.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Now to a caller in Fairfax, Virginia. Good morning, Lynn. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. I have two questions. The first is, why is 4 months too late to respond to, in this particular way, to the sinking of the ship? It seems that people can make the connection in their head between this exercise and the sinking. And we responded initially very quickly and pursued diplomatic means first, and I don't see why 4 months is too short a time. And the other question relates to the great opportunity that exists because of the world economic situation. Europe and the United States are pretty tied up and would be unable to respond to a land invasion, I think, of South Korea. And I'm just wondering if this isn't the perfect time for something like that to happen.
Courtney.
Well, I think it's 4 months. It's not that it's too late of too long of a time to respond, but I think at this point, these military exercises are now being seen as more of a show of force or sending a strong signal to North Korea and by extension to China, as opposed to a direct response to the sinking of the Cheonan. The exercises involve some anti-submarine warfare training for the South Koreans to defend against an attack like this in the future. But it's less of a direct tie to the attack itself than it is to the show of force. And one other thing about the land invasion, keep in mind, this doesn't get a whole lot of media attention, but the U.S. still has about 28,000 troops in South Korea right now and is still under a mandate to be protecting that country. So it's not an insignificant presence that exists there still.
Diane, there is one thing we haven't talked about today, and that is that Secretary Clinton announced new sanctions, unilateral U.S. sanctions against North Korea. North Korea is one country on the planet that really is vulnerable to economic sanctions. We saw this a few years ago when the United States moved against a bank in Macau that was linked to the North Korean regime regime's activities in money laundering, and it really had an immediate effect. So that is a sensible response.
You know, what troubles me is that I know that these sanctions are supposed to be against the upper echelon of the North Korean society, but these people are already starving, and any sanctions whatsoever are surely going to hit the lower part of that society, Moises.
Yes, and that's why there is a whole wave of trying to develop what the experts call smart sanctions that try to avoid hitting the population. These ones, the recent ones that Tom was referring to, are targeted to luxury goods that are purchased by the elites and by the entourage around the leadership, and arms. That doesn't mean that there will not be perhaps consequences. It's very easy to disdain sanctions and just predict that they will not work because they very often don't work. And it's very easy to just be very negative about them. But remember that the alternative is worse.
The alternative.
To sanctions. Very often the alternative to sanctions is war.
I surely hope that we're not talking about yet another war. I won't be talking about anything like war in the next couple of weeks. I'm going on vacation. I'll be back with you August the 12th. I'll be missing you, but I'm looking forward to my vacation. I want to thank our guest today, Moises Naim of País, El País, Courtney Cuby of NBC News, Tom Gelton, correspondent for NPR. Thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Diane Rain.